The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. With our celebrating Mother's Day this month, I do have two articles that I would like to share with you about mothers. The first one, Saturdays with Mom, and this was written by Katie Martin. In the 1960s, as a small child, I looked forward to my Saturday with Mom. One of eight children, I was given a chance to spend time with Mom alone when it was my Saturday. Sometimes we rode the bus downtown into Minneapolis, Minnesota. Other times we took the car. It was always a trip to remember. We would start out shopping. Often Mom would buy our clothes when we were with her. Other times we would be looking for something for one of my brothers and sisters. It might be a coat, a dress, or even a pair of shoes. Back then, all of the Boy Scout and Girl Scout uniforms and so forth were carried by the department stores. I always wanted to look at all the genuine Girl Scout camping equipment, like the camping knives, shovels, and axes. When lunchtime came, we would go to the top of Dayton's department store to eat in their wonderful restaurant. It was quiet there and gave us a rest from the continuous ringing of telephones and the loud-coded bongs of their paging system. I always ate the same thing, grilled cheese sandwich, plain chips, and a cola. Their grilled cheese was always grilled to perfection. It was perfectly brown, cooked in butter, and so delicious. Their glasses were always so clean that they shone in the sunlight. I can hear the ice clinking and rattling as it moved in that clear glass. Even the potato chips seemed perfect. Round and salty, each one had a little crunch. Sitting there with my mom on Saturday afternoon, I always thought I was the luckiest child in the world. Mom and I usually didn't talk about school or that type of stuff. We would talk about what we needed to buy for each family member. Mom always asked my opinion. More often than not, my ideas would be incorporated into our shopping plans. After lunch, we would go to the other stores downtown. As we walked between the stores, there was always time for peeking in the store windows. The colors were so bright. There was everything you ever dreamed about or even thought about on the other side of those windows. During the holiday seasons, I would have to be dragged from those windows. You see, everything was animated then. A train would run around a Christmas tree. Someone would hand someone else a present. The lights would twinkle in a spectacular tree. I can even remember Santa with his ho, ho, ho. At Easter time, the Easter bunny would move. Every holiday was a new delight. My eyes would be as big as saucers. My smile would fill my face as I watched all the movement in those windows. To a child like me, this was a time of wonder, a time of dreaming. There was no better time. Mom would finally drag me away from the window so we could continue shopping. Our list of things to buy were always longer than the time we had to shop for everything. The last thing we would do was go to Donaldson's basement for the best chocolate ice cream cone. It was twirled round and round. The clerk always seemed to sense my excitement and make that ice cream so tall that it would almost fall off the cone. Of course, I had to lick hard and very rapidly to keep that from happening. Mom and I would discuss all of our purchases on the way home. I often had to take things out of the bags so we could make sure what we had gotten. All of this just added to my excitement. I couldn't wait to get home and show my father and my brothers and sisters what we had purchased. I never cared if the purchases were for me. It just wasn't important. The trip itself and the time spent with Mom was the real gift. Jennifer Hess submits the next story about her mom, and it's titled A Blossoming May Day Celebration. A light, warm breeze blew joyfully through my bedroom window that Saturday morning. Mom sat on the edge of my bed, lightly caressing my curly tendrils. Her soft voice gently awakened me. "Honey, wake up. It's May Day today." Her bright blue eyes sparkled with anticipation. One of my mother's favorite days of the year was May 1st. She had once been a May Day princess as a young girl. As a result, May Day celebrations in our home were always festive. Mom let us bypass our regular Saturday morning chores, which made my brother and me ecstatic. She was busy in the kitchen preparing food for our picnic luncheon. Excitedly, I picked up the telephone and dialed my best friend, Missy. I couldn't wait to invite her and her younger sister over for the May Day festivities. The heavenly scent of Mom's lemon blackberry bread filled the kitchen as she set the loaf pan on the stove to cool. Missy and Marcy arrived quickly at our back door. They must have ridden their bikes faster than the wind that day. Mom handed us scissors and a large woven basket. She instructed us to go outside and cut flowers for bouquets. Arm in arm, we burst through the front door giggling with excitement. Fragrant snow-white spiry blossoms, cheerful tulips, and pastel peonies surrounded the front of our house. We carefully trimmed the flower stems, filling our basket. Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, we rushed up the front steps into the house. Mom had been busy prepping our table with brightly colored construction paper, ribbons, and glue. She patiently showed us how to arrange small bouquets of flowers. Then we rolled and glued pieces of pastel construction paper into cones, adding ribbon hangers. We carefully placed each flower bouquet in our homemade cone-shaped baskets. Mom loaded us up in the car. We stopped at homes of friends and family where we surprised them with freshly arranged May Day baskets. Our hearts were full. At the park that afternoon, we enjoyed a tasty picnic of Italian sausage, zucchini casserole, rotini salad, and the other delicious dishes. The next article I want to share with you is submitted by Carrie Mitchell, and it's titled, A Sunday at Wrigley Field. When I was a kid, my friends and I would meet up at the local playground, weather permitting, of course, and choose up sides. If there were six of us, we would pick two teams of three and play pitcher's hands out. A defensive player can throw to the pitcher for a forced out at first base. We would play until around noon, run home for a sandwich, and then play until the street lights came on. That was our signal to head home. Street lights meant game over. This was a fast and firm rule with all of our moms. We all lived within a block of the playground, so we could be home in a few minutes. Mothers of that era, late 1950s, early 1960s, knew that we would never violate the streetlight rule, and we didn't. By 1963, the games continued, but with less frequency. We were getting ready for the next phase of our youth. Eighth grade was up next for me, and for a few of my older friends, high school loomed with its challenges. But baseball was never far in the background. When the school year ended, we would fill our days with Cubs chatter. Living where I did in northwestern Indiana, the Cubs became my team. Northwest Indiana, Hammond to be precise, is just a few minutes from the city limits of Chicago. That meant you could root for either the Cubs or the White Sox. I think I was predestined to be a Cubs fan. When I was growing up, the Cubs games were telecast on WGN Channel 9. Jack Brickhouse, the Cubs' play-by-play man, was an announcer of unbridled enthusiasm. Up by six or down by six, Jack was always upbeat and full of optimism. My mom and dad were both Cubs fans of many years, and my grandfather was a fan of an even earlier vintage, going back to the Cubs team of the early 20th century. My father remembered the golden era of 1929 to 1938 when we won three pennants and never finished worse than third. The Cubs got off to a fast start in 1963 and in early June were tied for first place after a three-game sweep of the Giants at Wrigley Field. It was still early in the season, but for a Cubs fan, being tied for first place in early June was reason to celebrate. The Dodgers, with their dominant pitching and jackrabbit base runners, were coming up next for a weekend series. I was excited and hoped that maybe my dad would spend one of his rare days off journeying up to the north side of Chicago. My dad worked hard in his job as a meat cutter. My mom worked hard as well in the courtesy booth of a local store. Both would be off work on Sunday, but would they feel like taking on the notoriously heavy Sunday traffic that Chicago was known for? I got my answer around 8 a.m. Sunday when I woke and found my mom making sandwiches. "Your dad is getting the car gassed up. We're going up to the game today with Walt and Marty, so get washed and get ready to go. You know your dad. He'll want everybody ready when he gets back," Mom said. Walt was a family friend, and Marty, his son, was around my age. It promised to be a fun day at beautiful Wrigley Field. The Cubs had dropped the first two games of the Dodgers series, but my disappointment was tempered by the prospects of the day ahead. The trip to Chicago on that warm Sunday was slow going, but I always enjoyed the beautiful vista that was Lakeshore Drive. Lake Michigan was calm, and the boats that lolled on the small waves were picturesque. But what made the view so impressive was the Chicago skyline. Skyscrapers reached majestically toward the sky in seemingly endless rows of gleaming gray and sun-drenched white. The dreaded S-turn loomed, but my dad, a dedicated and cautious driver, conquered the turn with his usual style. The traffic was thick on this warm Sunday as we got to the north side. Chicago has always been a city of neighborhoods. The north side, with Wrigley Field serving as a linchpin, was no different. It had older houses and modern clubs, and I was always excited, even as a kid, to reach its outskirts. Next came the challenge of finding a parking spot. On this day, with 35,000 people expected, parking was at a premium. We ended up about a mile away, but that was okay. Seeing the smile on my dad's face put a bounce in his step. We got to one of the ticket booths, purchased three grandstand tickets, and started up the ramp. The sounds, the smells, and the overall ambiance of Wrigley Field are a unique joy. Then came the supreme moment. That moment when the field comes into view for the first time has always given me a unique euphoria. It is an expanse of green that is a treat to the eyes. The outfield grass and the wall of ivy remind me of a picnic ground. After we arrived, we had an hour before the game started, and the talk in the stands centered on the pitching. Los Angeles was starting Sandy Koufax, probably the best pitcher of his time. A snapping curveball and a blazing fastball made a pitch by Koufax almost impossible to hit. Dick Ellsworth was pitching for the Cubs, and he was in the midst of his best season. The promise of a pitcher's duel was in the air, and that was okay with me. I loved good pitching. What happened was just the opposite. Ernie Banks homered in his first at bat, which gave me great joy. By the time the game ended, Banks had launched three over the ivy-covered wall, the first two off the great Koufax. It was a career day for Ernie, but it was wasted as the Dodgers outscored the Cubs 11-8. The ride home was quiet, as it usually was after a Cubs loss, but the season closed with promise as my team ended the season with an 82-80 record, the first record over break-even in my memory. I have remained a loyal Cubs fan into my dotage, and in 2016, in a grand moment, the Cubs won the World Series, the first time since 1908. When that happened, I thought of my mom, dad, and grandfather, all of whom would have cherished the moment. I was happy that I could share the moment with my wife, who loves the Cubs as much as I do. I thought of all those games I went to as a kid. I was glad I had that experience, because when that moment in 2016 happened, I had already been indoctrinated into the exclusive club of patient Cubs fans. And here's a little side note to that article I just read. Presidents have had a long history of throwing out ceremonial first pitches at baseball games. The first president credited with the feat was William Howard Taft in 1910. Franklin D. Roosevelt threw out a first pitch during a Washington Senators versus Boston Red Sox game in 1934, one of the 11 first pitches he threw during his presidency. From the Bits and Pieces section, I have two short stories to share with you. The first one, You're a Truck, by Diana Vickery. The ink was barely dry on my first driver's license when my best friend Jolene and I embarked on a 700-mile road trip. Her husband-to-be was completing officer candidate school, and the young lovers planned a wedding in the Aberdeen Proving Ground Chapel in Maryland. I, her maid of honor, was going along to help with driving. Jolene owned a 2-year-old 1965 Ford Mustang and was planning to pull a rented trailer loaded with everything she owned, clothes, household goods, and wedding presents. Neither of us had pulled a trailer before. We departed from Jolene's house in Aurora, Illinois, with a crowd of her relatives to see us off. They didn't show it, but they were all worried we'd get in trouble on the road and speculated about exactly when we'd turn back. They were right to be worried. We made it around the bottom edge of Lake Michigan and onto the Indiana Turnpike with no problem. When we spotted a rest area, we pulled in with nary a thought about how we'd pull out. While Jolene tried to back out, I helped by waving my arms, but the car and trailer went all cattywampus and we panicked. Before we had a mutual meltdown, sure that we'd never make it to Maryland, a truck driver, an older guy of our parents' generation, ambled over. "Having a little trouble, ladies?" he asked. With Jolene's blessing, he got into the driver's seat and deftly backed the car and trailer out. Remember, when you're driving a car that's pulling a trailer, you're a truck. At a rest area, you follow the truck's arrow and park where they do. Then you don't need to reverse to leave, he said. With profuse thanks to our knight of the road, we got back into the turnpike and made it to Maryland. The wedding came off without a hitch, and 57 years later, the young lovers are still together. And the next story is titled Saturday Night Treat by Dolores Stewart. When I was a child growing up in the 1940s in a little village outside Buffalo, New York, my family didn't have much money. That meant we didn't get anything extra that wasn't really necessary. My father was a local barber, and Mom stayed home to take care of my brother and me. Our parents made sure we had all we really needed. 3 meals a day, family gatherings, church every Sunday, and plenty of outside activities. We never got treats except one day a week. That was Saturday night, which was payday for my father. He would bring home a pint of Neapolitan ice cream, a cube of delicious vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry flavors. Mom would cut it equally into 4 wonderful slices. It was so good. So it's no wonder that now, at 82 years old, I still love ice cream. Of course, with so many flavors to choose from now, I enjoy more than those 3. But if I have a dessert choice, it'll always be ice cream. Joe Palermo submits an article titled, What's Wrong with Being a Spy? Growing up, I wanted to be a secret agent. I had no real idea what they did, but based on what I saw in the movies, I would get to drive cool cars, kill bad guys with clever gadgets, and hang around with pretty girls. My influences were James Bond films and secret agent Napoleon Solo in the TV show The Man from U.N.C.L.E. The movie From Russia with Love taught me that some pretty girls couldn't be trusted and might try to kill you. She could prove helpful if, just before you kissed her, you could see the reflection of the enemy sneaking up behind you in her eyes. That would give you a chance to spin her around to stop a bullet and save your life, though it definitely ruled out a second date. I fed my dream by getting my parents to buy me as many spy toys as possible. There were many to choose from in 1965. The centerpiece was the Secret Sam attaché case, which contained a camera inside that could secretly take pictures without opening it. The photos didn't remain secret for long, as they had to be dropped off for development at Walgreens or Photomat, where several teenagers might sneak a peek. There was also a button on the side of the case, which, when pressed, would fire a bullet through a hole from the gun inside. The weapon could be assembled into a mini rifle containing a periscope for seeing over walls. It also had a red missile where a secret message could be stashed and then fired from the gun. Sadly, when one of my friends used the periscope to peer over our fence, I fired the red message missile directly into it, shattering the glass mirror and destroying its future resale value. Not that that idea was on my radar at the time. Fortunately, my friend's eye was still there, and he was unharmed. My most unusual gadget was called Six Finger. This was basically a plastic finger that could fire various projectiles. Based on its large size and color, it worked well for a Caucasian adult, but stood out a lot if you were a little kid or a person of color. It had a ballpoint pen attachment and could also fire a secret message missile. It seemed there were many secret messages to be communicated back then, though I never knew to whom or why. Later, I also got the James Bond attaché case, which contained a plastic throwing knife in the side. Instead of firing bullets, it had a booby trap. A cap would fire if someone tried to open it without the right combination. I usually forgot the numbers and triggered it myself, as no one else cared enough to look inside. As I grew older, my spy aspirations dissipated when I realized the profession could be hazardous to my health. Working as an adult businessman, in the spirit of my early dreams, I always kept my real attaché case close, though it never contained anything more dangerous than my lunch. And now I have a poem that I would like to share with you, and this is Out in the Fields with God by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. The little cares that fretted me, I lost them yesterday among the fields above the sea, among the winds that play, among the lowing of the herd, the rustling of the trees, among the singing of the birds, the humming of the bees. The foolish fears of what might pass, I cast them all away, among the clover-scented grass, among the new-mown hay, among the hushing of the corn, where drowsy poppies nod, where ill thoughts die and good are born, out in the fields with God. And here's a couple of items of flashback fun for you. On May 8, 1961, America's first astronaut in space, Alan B. Shepard, received the Distinguished Service Medal from President John F. Kennedy in the White House Rose Garden. 17 days later, President Kennedy addressed Congress, stating that the U.S. should commit to the goal of putting a man on the moon before the end of the decade. Percy Spencer invented the first microwave oven after he noticed a chocolate bar melted in his pocket while he was working on a radar set with a cavity magnetron tube in 1945. The first microwave for home use was produced by Amana in 1967 and cost nearly $500. From Things My Parents Used to Say. Whenever her family was running low on necessities like groceries, water, or heat, Joyce Forrest of Olean, New York, remembers her mother saying they were going to have to Hooverize. If Diane Scott's dad wasn't feeling well, he would often say, "I look or feel like a month of bad weather." Leroy White shared that if he asked his parents for something he wanted when he was a child, his parents would respond either, "It's not what you want that makes you fat, it's what you get," or "A little want never hurt anyone." Leroy shared that he might not have liked to hear it back then, but oh, how he would love to hear those words again. Babe Ruth once said, "Never let the fear of striking out keep you from playing the game." We've run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.